Our sermon passage today is Ecclesiastes 5, verses 8 through 20. Ecclesiastes is found in the Old Testament after the book of Proverbs. Please open your Bibles to Ecclesiastes 5, 8 through 20, and follow along. Please stand for the reading of God's word. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. And he came from his mother's womb, he shall go, as he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. You may be seated.
Well, this morning we continue our sermon series in the book of Ecclesiastes. And if you've been with us for any length of time throughout this series, then you know that the author of Ecclesiastes, better known as the preacher, who is probably Solomon, has been talking about and writing about all that he has observed and all that he's seen during his life here under the sun. And so if you remember over the last five or so chapters, he's talked about the injustices that he's seen, the oppression that he's seen. He's talked about the people that he's seen living in isolation. He's talked about the seasons and the different cycles of life. He's talked about work. He's talked about pleasure. He's talked about wisdom. He's talked about eating. He's talked about drinking. He's talked about a whole host of other topics and areas of life that he's observed and seen and personally experienced himself during his life here under the sun. And his main takeaway from all that he's seen, if you remember, is that it's all hevel. That's the Hebrew word that literally means breath. It means a puff of smoke. It means a vapor or mist. That's what everything in this life here under the sun, Solomon says, it's like. Nothing is solid. Nothing is able to be grasped. Nothing is able to be held on to. Nothing is able to be controlled. Nothing is able to be fully comprehended and made sense of. Our passage this morning, then, he's going to bring up another topic or area of life that he's seen and observed during his life under the sun. And it's a topic that the author here is Solomon, that he knows a whole lot about. It's the topic, everyone's favorite topic, of money and how people relate to money. This topic here, no, probably isn't the topic that got you out of bed this morning, thinking, oh, I can't wait for whoever's preaching this morning to preach on money. The same time, if you think about it, this is a really relevant topic for everyone in this room this morning. Like we live in a culture and world in which we're swimming in an ocean of affluence and materialism and money and wealth and prosperity and possessions, like all over the place. Not only that, but this is a topic in which we all, every single one of us, wrestle with in terms of decision making. It's a topic in which we're all faced with different questions and decisions that we're trying to make every single day of our lives when it comes to money, when it comes to possessions. We're all asking questions like, what should my budget look like? We're all asking questions like, how can I cut expenses? How can I make more income? I'm struggling to make ends meet, so what should I do? How much savings should I have? Should I have any savings? Is it wrong to have savings? Where's the line between saving and hoarding? Is it okay to go in debt? How do I get out of debt? How much is too much for a house? How much is too much to pay for rent? How much should my living expenses be? How much should I give? What's the line between greed and materialism and being a good steward of the money that we've been given? What's the line between spending on luxury items and items that we just think are fun and that we can enjoy for ourselves? Is that even permissible for a Christian to do? Should we all just sell our stuff and live under a bridge? Like, all those questions are questions that we, maybe not that last one, I don't know, but questions that we're wrestling with, that we're having to make hard decisions about in our practical everyday life, whether you have a lot of money or little money. They're all questions we face. But as important as every single one of those questions are, there's a greater, more significant question that lies underneath all those other more practical questions that we first need to answer in order to answer all those other practical questions that I just asked. And that greater, more significant question is the foundational question that we need to ask ourselves when it comes to money, when it comes to possessions in general. And that question, foundational question that we need to ask in order to answer all those other practical questions is this. It's that as a Christian, and as Christians, how are we to relate to money? How are we to relate to money? In other words, as followers of Jesus, how are we to view money? How are we to think about money? What should our perspective be towards money? How are we to understand money? How are we to understand wealth? How are we to understand prosperity? How are we to understand possessions? As Christians, what's our relationship to money supposed to look like in our lives? Well, if we don't answer that question first, then there's no way in the world we're going to be able to answer all those 100 other practical questions that affect our everyday lives and our personal individual finances. And this, then, is where our passage this morning is going to come to be very, very helpful for us. That in our passage this morning, Solomon is going to give us two contrasting ways to relate to money. Two contrasting ways to relate to money. One of the ways that he's going to give us is a negative way. So it's the wrong way that we're to relate to money and possessions. The other way that he gives is the positive way. It's the proper way, the fitting way that we're to relate to money and we're to relate to possessions. And so as we dig into this passage this morning, we see these kind of polar opposite contrasting ways of how we're to relate to money and possessions. I pray that in doing so, it will give us a solid biblical foundation that will help us and enable us to answer all these other practical questions that we are confronted with and have to make decisions on about money and possessions in our everyday lives and our own personal finances. So the first way Solomon tells us that we're to relate to money in our passage is this. It's the negative way. So this is the way we're not to relate to money. We're not to, you see this on your handout, we're not to love money. We're not to love money. So this is the main theme and topic of the majority of this passage, starting in verse 8 through verse 17. It's about the love of money. And it's important to note in these verses what Solomon is warning against. He's not warning against money. He's not warning against money in and of itself. Instead, the warning that he's giving in verses 8 through 17 is not about money, it's about the love of money. He's warning, in other words, against greed. He's warning against discontentment. He's warning against the selfish, ambitious longing and love of more and more and more and more stuff. And this, then, is something that we can all struggle with. Like, this isn't just a sin of the rich. This is a sin that can be a sin of the poor, a sin of the middle class, the sin of the rich. It doesn't matter who you are, rich, middle class, or poor. We can all struggle with the love, this greed of having more and more money and more possessions if we're not careful. And so then, before we dive into these verses, here are some maybe diagnostic questions to help you maybe evaluate your own heart and to see if there's any, even a hint of just a growing love of money and love of possessions in your heart. Here are a few questions. Do you find yourself sacrificing your integrity for money? Do you find yourself sacrificing your family for money? Do you find yourself sacrificing your friends and relationships and even church for money? What makes you happiest? What puffs your chest out a little bit? What brings you the most joy? A deposit in your bank account? The stock market growing up? A big purchase that you've always wanted and that you finally get and that you finally made? Or the things of the Lord? Is giving and being generous hard for you? Are you normally discontent, never satisfied, always wanting more, wanting the newest and better gadget or trend that's out there? Do you often find yourselves comparing yourselves with what other people have and being jealous and being envious of what they have, of where they live, of what they drive, of the lifestyle that they have? Do you find yourself looking to money to be and do for you what only God was meant to be and do for you? In other words, do you look to money to be your security? Do you look to money to be your peace? Do you look to money to be your contentment? Do you look to money for your identity and to define your worth and your value and your significance? Like, if you can resonate with some or most of these questions that I just asked, then verses 8 through 17 are specifically for you. Because in these verses, what Solomon is going to do, he's going to give us five different dangers, five different warnings when it comes to loving money. And the first danger that he's going to give us is this. You see it on your hand out there. Is that the love of money can lead to the mistreatment of others. The love of money can lead to the mistreatment of others. This is what he gets at in verses 8 and 9 here. Look at verse 8. Solomon says, if you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. So if you've been with us for any length of time in this series on Ecclesiastes, this is the second time that Solomon brings up this topic of oppression. The first time we saw it was in the very beginning of chapter 4 and in verse 1. But each time he brings up this topic of oppression, it always precedes a passage on greed or envy or the love of money. And that's just not a coincidence. Instead, the reason that he does that, oppression followed by an extended passage on greed and envy and the love of money, is that Solomon wants us to see the connection between the two. He wants us to see the relationship between the two, the relationship between loving money and how that drives and fuels oppressing others, loving money and how that drives and fuels exploiting others. And look who Solomon then, in verse 8, look who he says is doing the oppressing, or who the oppressor is at the end of verse 8. He says, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. And so the high officials that he's talking about here are probably a reference to the government. It's probably a reference to government or political officials, especially since in verse 9, he talks about the king. And so what Solomon is describing here is this network of government corruption. It's this network of government oppression and exploitation in which one official is over another, and another official is over him, and another official is over him, so that you have this systemic pyramid scheme of oppression and injustice that makes its way layer by layer through the government from the top down, ultimately leading to what we see in verse 9 here when Solomon says, but this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. So verse 9 there is a really, really hard verse to translate, and it's a really, really hard verse to interpret and make sense of. But the gist of verse 9 would be this. It's that the workers in the field are tending their crops. The workers in the field are working hard. They're plowing their fields and doing all the work on the land. And in the end then, you have the king that comes in and takes all the gain. He takes all the profit from all the land and from all their hard work and from all their labor. Which means the picture is you have this king then that's sitting at the top of this pyramid scheme of oppression and exploitation of the poor that works its way down through every layer of government. In the middle of verse 8 then, Solomon tells us then how we should respond when we see this. How we should respond when we hear about this going on. Look in the middle of verse 8. See what he says? He says, don't be amazed by it. In other words, don't be surprised. Don't be shocked. Don't be like, oh, look, I can't believe that. Instead, he's saying, don't be surprised. You should expect it. You should expect it. Now, that doesn't mean, when he says don't be amazed by it, he doesn't say, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be heartbroken by it. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be angry by it. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be stirred to action to do something about it. But it does mean that we shouldn't be shocked by it, that we shouldn't be surprised by it. Because that's what life is like under the sun. We live in a fallen, broken world under the sun. And this is what life is like. That doesn't mean then that every government, doesn't mean that every politician, it doesn't mean that every government official is oppressive and exploits others and is corruptive and greedy and all those things. I'm definitely not saying that. At the same time, all we have to do is look at the history of the world in which we live to be able to see that some, if not many, are. And so then, this is what the love of money does. Put verse 8 and 9 within the context of the rest of this passage. This is what the love of money does. That instead of loving people and using things, the love of money causes us to love things and use people. It can cause us to love things and trample over people. It can cause us to love things and exploit people. It can cause us to love things and lie and cheat and steal and manipulate others in order to get things, in order to get a higher paying job, in order to get a more of a return on our tax return, in order to get more income on the house that we sell, in order to get more commission or income in a business deal, or a whole host of other things. The love of money is the fuel that can drive us to mistreat others. That's the first danger that Solomon mentions when it comes to the love of money. The second danger or warning then is this. It's that money is unable to satisfy you. That money is unable to satisfy you. This is what Solomon goes on to say in the very next verse in verse 10. Look there. He says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. In other words, if you love money, then enough is never going to be enough. You're never going to be satisfied if you love money. Your love of money is kind of like your appetite for food, right? But think about how your appetite for food is a picture of your love for money and those who love money. Like, what do you do when you get hungry? You eat, right? But what happens then a few hours later? You get hungry again. Why? Because that meal that you ate 3, 4, 5 hours ago didn't permanently satisfy you. Instead, 3, 4 hours later, you're hungry again. And the same is true then when it comes to those who love money. Like a salary increase, buying a house, buying a car, going on a dream vacation, buying this or buying that or whatever else might satisfy you for a day or two or maybe for a week. But if you're greedy and you love money, then it's not going to be enough. Then instead, you're going to want more. Then after you get more, you're going to want more. And then after you get more, you're going to want more. And after you get more, you're going to want more. And it's this endless cycle of discontentment that never stops because you're never satisfied. Because those who love money can never get enough. They're always discontent. They always want more. It's the second danger when it comes to the love of money. Third danger he mentions here is this, is that money is never problem-free. Money is never problem-free. Verse 11 and 12 here, he mentions two specific problems when it comes to money and the love of money. First, he says, in verse 11, he says that money can increase the number of mouths that we have to feed. Can increase the number of mouths you have to feed. This is this point in verse 11. Look there. He says, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Can be kind of hard to follow verse 11 here, but his point here is pretty simple, is that when money increases, when your income increases, then guess what oftentimes increases with it? The number of people who consume it. The number of people who want a piece of the pie. Whether that be friends, whether that be family. I mean, if you win the lottery, just see how many friends and family you have that you never knew anything about. That's what he's saying here. The more you increase in income and money, the more will increase those who want to consume it and want a piece of it. Whether that be the government in taxes, whether that be the growing number of employees in your business, whether that be charitable organizations that reach out and ask for help, whether that be all the people that you need to hire and employ to maintain and take care of all your stuff, or anything else. Like one commentator put it this way, it's expensive to be rich. Carries with it a whole lot of other expenses and costs that you never even knew existed. But that's not the only new problem that comes with money, that money creates. The second problem he mentions here is that money can decrease the amount of sleep you get. This is his point here in verse 12. Look at verse 12. He says, sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. So do you see the contrast that he's making here? He's contrasting the sleep of a poor laborer. So this is a guy who works in the field, who works the land. And he's contrasting the sleep of a poor laborer with the sleep of a rich person. And he's saying here that the sleep of a poor, he's saying that a poor laborer sleeps better at night than a rich person. Which at first, when you hear that, you're like, that might seem backwards to you. But look at the reason that Solomon gives for why the rich person doesn't sleep well and for why the poor person does. It's because Solomon says at the end of verse 12 that the rich person has a full stomach. And that word full stomach there can literally be translated as plenty or abundance, Which means then that the reason that the rich person can't sleep at night is because he stays up all night tossing and turning, worrying about his abundance. He can't sleep at night because he's worrying about and tossing and turning and not worrying about all the plenty and all the abundance and the money and the wealth and the possessions that he has. That instead of sleeping, his eyes are wide open at 2 a.m. in the morning worrying about the stock market, worrying about his 401k, worrying about the business he owns and meeting payroll and all the rest of the responsibilities that he has that comes with all the stuff that he possesses. While the poor laborer doesn't have any of that stuff. And so he's conked out and sleeping like a rock. Here's the thing. Don't ever buy into the lie that believes that money will solve all your problems. If you only had a little more, it would solve all your problems. And the reality is, money creates a lot of other new problems that you never even knew existed. That's Solomon's point. So then leads to the fourth danger of loving money that Solomon mentions, which is this. It's that money is fleeting. It's fleeting. It's what he goes on to say in verse 13 through 16 here. And we see how money is fleeting in two ways in these verses. First, we see that money can be lost at any moment. Can be lost at any moment. This is Solomon's point in verse 13 and 14. Look at verse 13. He says, "There's a grievous evil that I've seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand." And so the picture that Solomon's describing here is a man who's accumulated a whole lot of riches, a whole lot of money, a whole lot of possessions, and he's stored all of his money, all his riches away. He's stored it away for himself. But one day, somehow, some way, this man loses it all. Solomon describes it as a bad venture, which probably has the idea of like a bad business deal or a bad investment or something like that. But somehow, someway, this bad venture causes this man who stored all of his stuff away, caused this man to lose all that he has. He's lost everything. Like everything is gone, just like in an instant. Just like that. All that he stored away, just all of it gone. And as a result, he doesn't have an inheritance now to pass on to his son. He didn't have anything to give to his son. It's all gone. And so this is another danger then when it comes to loving money. It's that no one is ultimately financially secure. Like no one. Like banks can fail. Governments can fall. Stock markets can crash. Currency can deflate. Goods can depreciate. Thieves can break in and steal. Property can burn to the ground. Like nothing is safe. Everything you have can be gone in a moment. And if you don't believe me, just ask Job. Everything gone. But that's not the only way that Solomon mentions that money is fleeting. The second way is this. It's that even if you get through this entire life without losing any of your money, and even if you get through this entire life keeping all the money that you've accumulated and stored away, you're going to lose it eventually because one day you're going to die and death is going to swallow up everything that you've ever accumulated and stored up. So what Solomon goes on to say there in verse 15 here, look at verse 15. He says, as he... talking about the father and the man here who's lost all of his riches in the previous couple verses there. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again. Naked as he came and shall take nothing for his toil. Naked as he came and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? In other words, we're going to leave this world the same way that we came in. Naked. Without even the shirt on our back. Without anything. We came into this world with nothing, and we're going to leave this world with nothing. We can't take any of this with us. That's why at the very end of verse 16, Solomon asked this question, what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Meaning for all these money and possessions. And the answer is there's no gain. There's no gain. There's no lasting gain. Because everything that we do gain in this life, all the money, all the possessions, all the wealth, and all of our stuff that we do gain and accumulate in this life will be taken away from us by death, causing us to leave this world the same exact way that we came in, with nothing. Nothing. Fifth and final danger he mentions then is this, is that the love of money can make you completely miserable. That's what he goes on and how he concludes this section in verse 17. Look at verse 17. He says, moreover, all his days, and the his that he's talking about is probably a reference to this owner, this man in verse 13 and 14, who lost all of his riches. That man, he eats now in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. In other words, this is how those who love money respond when the money that they love is taken away from them. It kills them. They go into a deep depression. It devastates them. Their life is miserable because the one thing that they loved more than anything else, they don't have it anymore. And instead, they're filled with an overwhelming sense of loneliness. That's what he means by darkness. And sadness and anger and rage. Because the one thing they love more than anything else is gone. This and that is what the love of money can do to us if we're not careful. And so then, those are the five warnings and dangers Solomon gives us when it comes to loving money and money. So the application, I don't think you need me to tell you this, but the application here is pretty obvious. It's clear, right? Don't love money. Like, don't be greedy for money. Don't make money your God. Don't make money your highest treasure. Don't make money your preeminent affection. Don't make money your greatest desire. Don't make money your preeminent love. Don't do it. See the dangers and the warnings. That's what's going to happen if you do it. So don't do it. It's obvious. It's clear. Like, logical, rational person then can read that and think, okay, I don't need to love money. And you're right. That's the point. But here's what I want you to catch. The reason that God warns us about treating money like this and loving money isn't because he's a cosmic killjoy. It's not because he's trying to withhold pleasure from you. It's not because he's trying to withhold joy from you. It's not because he's trying to make your life miserable here on earth. Instead, it's because money isn't worthy. Money isn't deserving of being your greatest treasure. Money isn't worthy or deserving of being your highest love. Money isn't deserving or worthy of being preeminent in your affection and life. The only person, the only thing that is worthy of any of these things is Jesus. And think about why that's the case. Like, whereas money and possessions are fleeting and can be taken away from you in an instant, Jesus can never be taken away from you if you're a Christian. Matthew 28:20 says, Jesus says, I am with you always, to the end of the age. Whereas money can never satisfy you, Jesus can. John chapter 4, verses 13 through 14, Jesus says, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. Or whereas money and the love of money will keep you awake at night, tossing and turning and worrying and being anxious about money, Jesus will cause you to sleep like a baby. If you're having trouble sleeping because you're anxious tonight, Psalm chapter 4, verse 8 says, in peace I will lie down and sleep. For you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. Whereas the love of money can cause us to mistreat others and trample over others and oppress others and exploit others and all of these things, Jesus causes us to selflessly love others, to sacrifice ourselves for the good of others, to generously use our money to give to others. Why? Because that's what he's done for us. That when we were lost, when we were dead in our sin, Jesus didn't oppress us. He didn't trample over us. He didn't exploit us. Instead, he sacrificially gave of himself for us by dying on a cross in our place to take the judgment and the wrath of God that we deserve for our sin that we've committed against him. And so then, in light of these warnings, and in light then of these corresponding promises that are found in Jesus, don't love money, love Jesus. That by the power of the Spirit and the hope of the gospel in you, make Jesus your ultimate treasure and your preeminent affection and your greatest hope and your security and your satisfaction, not money. Money isn't worthy and deserving of your love. Jesus is. All that then begs this question. All right, if this is how we're not to relate to money, if we're not to love it because all the dangers that we've seen and because Jesus is to be our greatest love, if we're not to love it, then how are we to relate to money then? Like, what's the right way for a Christian to think about and view and relate to money then? Well, thankfully, that's what Solomon goes on to tell us in the final three verses here of chapter 5. You can see this on your handout, that instead of loving money, like he warned us in verses 8 through 17, we're to view money as a momentary gift that God has given to us for our enjoyment to enjoy, rather than lasting gain that we're to love. That is a paradigm shifter. That is a paradigm shifter when it comes to how Christians and we are to think about money and relate to money. But look at verse 18. Like, this isn't just me saying this. Like, this is in the Bible. Look at verse 18. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting, so this is fitting, this is good, is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. 19. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power, here it comes, to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. Why? This is the gift of God. Verse 20, for he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. So do you see what Solomon is saying in these three verses here? He's saying, I'll kind of summarize all this, put all these three verses together. He's saying that we only have a few days of life here under the sun. Just a few days. And in these few days, God, in his goodness and kindness, has given us a gift to enjoy in these few days for our enjoyment to find pleasure in. And he calls this gift that he's given us his lot, or our lot. And that word lot means assigned portion. It would be like if I discovered a massive treasure this afternoon. And I go and I'm like, man, this treasure is way too much for me to have. I'm gonna divide up this treasure into smaller portions. And next Sunday, I'm gonna hand out portions to everybody that's here. Here's your portion. Here's your portion. Here's your portion. Here's your portion. And I'm handing all these portions from this massive treasure to everyone here that I'm allotting it out to you as a gift for you to take for your enjoyment and for your pleasure. Well, guess what? That's what God has done for us. Out of his goodness and out of his kindness, during the few days of our life here under the sun, he has given us a gift, an allotment, a portion for our enjoyment to enjoy, which then begs this question: what is it? What's the gift? What's our allotment? It's given to us for our enjoyment. Two things. Number one, our work, our toil, meaning all the things we're busy at doing during the day. It's our toil, that's our work, all things we do and are busy ourselves with. It's a gift to enjoy. So in verse 16, we saw that there is no lasting gain from all our toil and work in this life. So there's no lasting gain in it. There's no ultimate gain in it. But in verse 18, we see that even though there's no lasting gain in our toil, that doesn't mean then that our toil is meaningless. Doesn't mean that our toil then is worthless. Instead, there's still joy to be found in our toil, in our work. And do you know what that joy is? It's the joy of the work itself. That's the gift. That's the gift God has given to you and to me. That's our portion that He's allotted to us. Our work, the joy of our toil, the joy of our work to find enjoyment and pleasure in during our few days here under the sun. And that right here, I don't know about you, but that's like a complete mind blower. That's a complete mind shift. That instead of working because you love money so much and because you want to accumulate and buy a whole bunch of nice things and that have no lasting gain and that aren't worthy of your ultimate love and affections, you instead are to work for the enjoyment and the pleasure that's found in the work itself. In other words, you work for the joy of building something. You work for the joy of creating something new. You work for the joy of solving problems. You work for the joy of fixing something that was broken. You work for the joy of serving someone. You work for the joy of providing a service to someone. You work for the joy of helping someone. You work for the joy of planning something. You work for the joy of blessing others. You work for the joy of bringing joy to others. You work for the joy of the interest that you have in whatever your work is. You're just interested in it and you find joy in it. That's okay. Like, it's easy to view all of our work and all of our toil as just a necessary evil of this world in which we live. And as a burden that you just have to cross, you have to carry and bear the rest of your life. But have you ever taken time to view your work as a momentary gift? It's not going to last forever. Just a momentary gift from God, that in His kindness and goodness that He has given to you to work at in order to find pleasure and enjoyment in. That's a radically different way to think about work. But guess what? He didn't stop there. God gave us another gift. Not just work. He gave us another gift to enjoy. Verse 19 says that He's also given us the gift of money and wealth and possessions for our enjoyment. Look at verse 19. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power, here it comes, to enjoy them. Then look at the very end of verse 19. This is the gift of God. Like, can you believe that's in the Bible? Nobody ever told me that verse was in the Bible. Like, as Christians, we hear a whole lot about the dangers of money and how we're not to love money and how we need to be generous with our money and good stewards of our money. And yes and amen to all of that. But when was the last time you heard a pastor or a preacher tell you that you need to, that your money and your possessions are a gift that God has given you for your enjoyment? I've never told you that. That's what the Bible is telling you here. Again, no, we're not to love money. We're not to love possessions. Verses 8 through 17. Meaning, we're not to make them our ultimate treasure, our ultimate hope, our ultimate security, our preeminent affections, and all those things. We're not to treat our money and possessions as lasting gain, because they're not lasting gain. They're not going to last. Death is going to swallow it all up one day. At the same time, even though our money, even though our possessions aren't lasting gain, and even though we're not to love them and make them our ultimate treasure, we are to enjoy them. That's the tension. That's the balance of Ecclesiastes when it comes to money. And the reason we're to enjoy them is because they're gifts that have been given to us for our enjoyment and pleasure. If you're a parent, imagine giving your child a gift for his enjoyment or her pleasure, and they never find joy and pleasure in it. So then, the house you live in, it's a gift from God. The car you drive, it's a gift from God. The clothes in your closet that are on your back, a gift from God. The shoes in your closet, a gift from God. The food in your pantry, a gift from God. The furniture in your house, a gift from God. The golf clubs you may or may not have, a gift from God. The vacation you just went on, a gift from God. The money in your bank account, a gift from God. Money in your savings account, if there's anything in there, a gift from God. And even if there's $2 in there, it's a gift from God. The TV, the iPhone, the books, the world soccer games, concert tickets, movies, Royals, sort of, everything else. Gifts from God. And this is important to remember, because it's easy to think that all these things I mentioned and more, that we've acquired these things ourselves. That we've earned these things with our hard-earned money and our hard-earned work. But according to verse 19, the only reason you have any of these things is because God has given them to you as a gift. And as a gift then, yes, he wants you to be a good steward of it, and he wants you to be generous with it, and he wants you to be all of those things, but he's also given them to you for your enjoyment. So enjoy them. Now I know what some of you are thinking. Yeah, but. Can all this be taken too far? Can we use this verse to justify materialism and greed and stinginess and bad stewardship and all those other things? Well, obviously, yeah, of course. And that's a sermon for another time, and other verses address all that, and just like we saw earlier. At the same time, it's important that we don't just have a category for generosity and good stewardship and the warnings against loving money and the warnings against money being lasting gain and all those things when it comes to a Christian view of money. It's also important that we have a category of enjoyment, a category of gifts from God for our enjoyment. And so, do you have that category? And how does that category play itself out? And what's the balance and the tension look like when it comes to generosity and stewardship and not loving money and not looking at money lasting gain, but enjoying it as a gift from him? I'll be honest, I don't know perfectly and completely what that balance and what that tension practically looks like and plays itself out. But I do know it's worth wrestling with. And so then, how are we as Christians to relate to money? Well, this is obviously a far from exhaustive list that we've seen here this morning. But number one is, don't love it. Money isn't worthy of your highest love, Jesus says. Number two, enjoy it. Because whatever possessions and whatever money that you have, God has graciously given it to you for your enjoyment. Because guess what? God's not a cosmic killjoy. He's generous. He's benevolent. He's a father who loves to lavish and give his children good gifts for their enjoyment. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your kindness and your goodness to us. in so many ways of how we've not always seen that and or even embraced it in our lives. So thank you for whether there's $5 in our bank account, that's $5 more than what we deserve. It's not $5 that we've earned, it's $5 that you've graciously given to us. Or whether there's $5 million, all of it's a gift, undeserved, from a generous God, giving to his children good gifts. And so, God, I pray that as we find joy in these gifts, I pray that they would point us back ultimately to the giver of those gifts, and the praise and the joy that we would find ultimately. And yes, the gifts, but also ultimately in a more preeminent, heightened sense and sort of way, and the giver of all those good gifts in you. And we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.